Welcome to the MS Dev Show, episode number 158. This week, we talk with Lena Hall about functional programming in F#. Which is faster than mouse or keyboard? Walmart tells vendors to get off Amazon's cloud. And using AI to play Ms. Pac-Man.
Raygun gives you complete visibility on errors, crashes, and performance problems affecting your end users. Replicate issues in seconds rather than digging through log files or having to rely on users to report errors or crashes. Raygun gives you a window into how users are really experiencing your software applications. Check it out today at raygun.com. This episode of the MS Dev Show is brought to you by Espose, the market leader of .NET and Java APIs for file business formats. Natively work with DocX, XSLX, PPT, PDF, MSG, MPP, image formats, and many more.
This week we have Lena Hall, senior engineer in Microsoft Research, writing in F# every day, previously worked on big data distributed systems. Welcome.
Hi.
So before we get into it, Carl, what's going on with that conference?
I just want to remind everybody that if you have the chance to go to Central Wisconsin at the beginning of August, there is an amazing conference called That Conference, and we will be there. So if that is your cup of tea, check it out. They have all sorts of development stacks, Microsoft and others as well. So if you're looking to just see what's the latest and greatest in the development sphere in general, it's a great place to go. And once again, we'll be there. So you'll have a chance to connect with both Jason and I.
Yeah. And it's literally called That Conference. Like I was talking to somebody recently and I mentioned that, and they're just like, well, you're going to have to tell me the conference name. Like, no, it's
no,
called
it's
that
conference.
Yeah.
So we just go to thatconference.com.
Yeah, exactly.
And buy yourself a ticket. It's actually pretty cheap for a 3-day long national level conference.
Exactly. And then you had a note in here about Slack.
Yeah. We've been having a bunch of great conversations on Slack. So if you want to join us on that as well, go to slack.msdevshow.com to send yourself an invitation and check it out. Had a really cool conversation about, being able to teach yourself certain things and how people teach themselves versus, being mentored by somebody else on topics. So if you want to have geeky and non-geeky discussions, check it out there.
Perfect. And what do we have for the comment of the week?
So this week, the comment of the week gets a developer small business license for Espose.total for .NET. We got an email from Christoph Vollmer, and he said, hey guys, I'm listening to your podcast, pretty regularly. I'm commuting to work every day by train, so lots of time for the podcast. For me, it's a perfect addition to elvinashcroft.com, which he follows daily. Elvin gets him a lot of small ideas and new stuff daily that he can look into or skip. And the MS Dev Show gives him detailed information about things that are of interest most of the time. He's been in IT 20 years, and he's been working .NET pretty much ever since it's been around. Staying up to date with all the MS Microsoft and .NET stuff is vital. So he thanks us for the good work and asks us to keep it up. A few things that he has comments on is we've been talking a lot about IoT and like house temperature stuff. Mm-hmm. And he sent us a link. If you go to Wikipedia and search for passive house, he says his brother has one and he's about to build one. He says the temperature is always perfect because it's a whole house system, not just insulation, but also ventilation and other things too. So if any of our listeners are into kind of that sphere, check it out. In addition, he talks about mentions about when we talked about how Stack Overflow went to HTTPS. Mm-hmm. He says there's been other companies who've been pretty public about their journey into transitioning to HTTPS, such as The Guardian.
Okay, so we should include that in the show notes then.
Yep, I'll definitely have those links. And he had a couple more, so I'll just put all of his links that he gave us out there because there's more.
This is a mega comment.
Yeah, and he says he also has a request to about a podcast on Azure Stack. He's still stuck with on-premise work, so Azure Stack would be a really good candidate.
Okay.
And I think that's a good feedback because, a lot of times we talk about Azure, but there's that really cool on-premises version that we don't always get to talk about a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you want to get mentioned on the show like Christoph, send us an email to feedback@msdevshow.com, comment on Facebook, YouTube, or Stitcher. We especially love those 5-star iTunes reviews.
Perfect. Okay, let's jump into the news because we got some really cool stuff to talk about here. The first one is probably one of the longest articles, but hopefully we can cover it in the shortest amount of time. Is the keyboard faster than the mouse? So it's coming back to this conversation. You want to summarize this, Carl?
Yeah, so I mean, we had Jeremy Foster on a while back talking just about like optimizing and learning keyboard shortcuts because your hands are on the keyboard, they never leave, they must be faster. Well, this article kind of looks at that research that was done in there and says, you know, that might not always be the case. Our assumptions might be flawed here, and using a mouse might be just as fast as using keyboard shortcuts. So if you want to look at what's probably a good 5 to 10 minute read, there's some pretty good ideas and comments showing that using a mouse might be equally as fast and in some cases faster than using a keyboard shortcut.
Yeah. Short version, it's complicated.
Yes.
So Lena, keyboard or mouse?
You can combine it. I wouldn't say one over the other.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if you were like a purist or not. And, you know, because like Carl said, we had Jeremy Foster on here and he's just like, mouse, you know, unplug it, throw it away. You know, keyboard for everything.
I mean, most of the times when you already know your shortcuts in your editor, you're pretty productive. But if you switch to somebody else's editor, you're like in a completely new universe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's where I wish some of these were a little bit more embedded in the operating system. Kind of like the keyboard shortcuts to like maybe select a word or select a line. They work really good in code and Visual Studio. A lot of times they line them up. But if you switch to another editor or heck, even go to Word or Notepad, those shortcuts are out the window. I mean, one of my favorite ones to use is to delete and or to cut a line is, you know, shift delete. It's just it works great in Visual Studio and code, but I wish it worked in Word and the rest of the Office products, or at least all of the Microsoft Sphere. That would be awesome if those could get standardized. I know that there's a whole backwards compatibility issue there that, you know, it would be hard to make that change, but it would be really nice to make progress towards that.
You know what I've been using recently a lot is Shift Alt and then the arrows for whenever you have like a bulleted list, whenever you have an outline for moving items around, because you can actually use your arrow keys to like indent, unindent, move items around. So I actually did that in the show notes, Carl. And that one I find to be like just magical. That's probably like my favorite keyboard shortcut ever, is the ability to do that. But anyway, this next one here, Microsoft uses AI to beat Miss Pac-Man. This one I thought was super cool because it's this machine learning problem, right? So AI equals machine learning. You know, that's kind of the short version, right? But what they did was, you know, this is a fairly complex game. So just throwing pure machine learning at it, it doesn't quite understand how to play the game. It's sort of complicated. So how do you like break down this problem and make it easier? And it was kind of neat because they basically built a whole bunch of different, you know, AI or ML bots. And what they would do is there was one, for example, that was, you know, just a bot to figure out which direction you would ideally go to get away from an enemy. You know, so if the enemy is on, if the ghost is on the right, you know, it's saying go left. And what it does is it's sending a strong signal that you should go left. Meanwhile, there's like another AI bot that's saying, well, you know what, there's pellets over there by that ghost. And it's just less strong of a signal saying, hey, we should go over that way. And what ends up happening is whenever you sort of list all these bots and put a weighting to the different signals that they're sending, you can figure out, you know, you can aggregate them and figure out the actual direction that you should go. And they maxed out the score in Ms. Pac-Man. So it works. It's a cool strategy.
And I learned a little bit about video games, too. I found out that Ms. Pac-Man is actually a lot less predictable than regular Pac-Man. It's not just like they reskinned it. It's totally different. Mm-hmm. And then not only that, but it's so unpredictable that it's actually one of the hardest early video games to beat and to get that maximum score on.
Yeah, because I think in Pac, I was about to say Mr. Pac-Man. Is he Mr. Man? Anyway, in Pac-Man, my understanding is like you can follow, you know, there's a certain like joystick combination where you can go through and solve a map, and then each one you just do it faster, you know, so you can sort of memorize like the ideal pattern for Pac-Man. I don't know if that's actually true or not, but that was my understanding. And yeah, Miss Pac-Man, it doesn't work like that. So much more difficult. So that's great. And then, you know, we're talking on machine learning, and Carl, you'd mentioned maybe I should bring this up. I don't know if you guys have this problem, and yeah, I guess you probably don't know because you might not have cameras, but you know, I have cameras around my house, and I actually never really looked at the footage because I usually only look at it whenever something goes wrong. Well, my wife left the van unlocked the one night, and everything was like all moved around in there. And she goes, "What's going on?" So I start looking at the footage, and sure enough, somebody came by, opened the door, and you know, because she left it unlocked and was moving through the things. I start going back, and here, this happens. From best I can tell, it happens every week, and it's even different people. People just come, they park in the neighborhood, and I promise this happens in like all different neighborhoods, right? They park their vehicle and they just walk around the entire neighborhood and they check every single car. So I actually have a whole bunch of photos of people trying to open our van, which sits outside. So, you know, the idea here is I think at some point here I'm going to train a machine learning model, probably using the vision services, because I've done this before to identify like different things going on in the photos that my security system generates. But, you know, I should be able to create an ML model that will actually tell me, hey, this is a bad person trying to break into your vehicle. And then I'll have to do something with those signals. But kind of interesting. Do either of you have cameras in the front and park a vehicle outside?
No, you know? I have a garage where we park everything We don't have that. But one of the areas I do want is I have a pool.
With this giant house.
Yeah. No, not really. But I have a pool, and, you know, for safety concerns, yeah. You know, I want a camera back there just in case something happens. Mm-hmm. So that would be nice. But, you know, while I'm at it, I might as well surround the house like you have.
Exactly.
So that's one thing I've been thinking about. I just haven't gotten around to.
Maybe that'll motivate me to document how I set mine up. But I cover every side of the house. So but, you know, little did I know that I'm just attempted robberies are happening every week. And I just suspect it's happening everywhere. Like, I don't think there's something unique about our neighborhood. The houses out here, I mean, people tend to park outside more because their garages are smaller than in Wisconsin. And, you know, so I think people tend to park outside more. Next one here. You are not Google.
Yeah, I would also like to add to this, you are not Amazon, you are not Microsoft, you are not LinkedIn, you're not Facebook, and so on and so forth. Really, what this article is about is a lot of times when one of these really cool companies create something and publish it, everybody just kind of jumps on it. One of the examples was back in the day when Google was talking about how they handled their big data solutions. They were talking about MapReduce and Hadoop, and that just took off like wildfire. All of a sudden, everybody had big data, and they were all using this, mm-hmm. And so on and so forth. You know, same with like Cassandra. You know, when that came out, everybody's like, "Oh, we've got to use that because this company is making it," and so on and so forth. But really, I mean, those companies are really optimizing for very specific things. And you know, if you have the exact same problem that they're having, or that fits that technology's strengths, and you don't have the weaknesses that you know go along with that, you know, maybe it would be a good fit. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times I really see the web really just jumping on these latest, greatest, cool things. And this guy came with probably one of the worst acronyms ever, UNFAT, with a PH. But he basically says, next time we find ourselves like trying to check out this new technology, we should understand the problem, you know, and try to figure out how to solve the problem. Directly.
Yep.
We should enumerate multiple solutions. Don't just like go with our favorite or go-to or whatever, man. This is.
I just want to use my favorites.
It says actually look at the paper, if there's a paper written on them. Basically research. Also look at the historical context. Weigh the advantages and disadvantages. And last of all, think. Mm-hmm. You know. So you know, if you use those, you're more likely to select the best solution. And this is really hitting me right now because I'm switching projects at work as a consultant. And, you know, one of the things that we have is on this OneNote page that says like technology decisions. And we're, you know, there's a bunch of them listed out. And some of them are like, do we really need a graph database, you know, for some of this? I'm like, you know, sometimes the tried and true, you know, the plain, boring stuff.
I was going to say, usually the answer to that is no. So I think that's why that's a good idea that the approach that you guys are taking. Cool. Yeah. I mean, I think people should check this out. I think it will give you some things to think about whenever you're choosing technologies. And then the last news story here, Walmart to vendors, get off of Amazon's cloud, which actually makes sense. I've actually run into this, you know, being in kind of the enterprise partner space. I've actually run into this quite a bit where, you know, these companies are, you know, Amazon is in retail. So they are directly competing with, you know, other retailers. So in general, retailers are like, I don't want to help my competitor.
Well, it's really interesting because you don't think of, you know, Walmart as a technology company. I mean, they use a lot of technology, mm-hmm. but because they're competing in the retail space, like you said, they don't want Amazon to succeed in any of Amazon's areas. Mm-hmm. So even though they don't have a stake in the cloud business, they don't want Amazon's cloud to succeed. So they're saying, hey, everybody should be using Azure, Google Cloud, or whatever else that isn't AWS. Mm-hmm.
And they probably also have this concern of, like, you know, storing their data there, but which I think is kind of silly because, I mean, they shouldn't, even if they are storing it with Amazon, they shouldn't be trusting Amazon. They should be encrypting it anyway with their own keys. And but, you know, there's always some perceived risk there. So, okay, well, let's get to Lena because we want to talk about F# and functional programming, which are some really cool topics. So yeah. I guess let's start with, you know, like what is functional programming and then where does F# fit into that?
Okay. So functional programming is, I would say it's a paradigm mm-hmm. of programming. You can do functional programming in most of the languages, but there are languages which are much easier to do functional programming, but like F#. Mm-hmm. So it's really concise, it's easier to debug and troubleshoot with, it's easier to set your mind on the correct programming to be able to find errors quickly and easily and think less, like think more about the real thing you're working on and less on like how to actually implement it and do it. It does require some understanding if you have another background, let's say if you started with object-oriented language like C# or Java. It will be different. It is a different paradigm and a different programming language. So there is definitely a mind shift.
Yeah, that actually brings up like, that, you know, I know that the way you said that was actually really simple, but it actually kind of blows my mind because now it has me questioning like everything, right? So whenever I first got into this, you know, you don't really think about it, but you have to adjust your brain to a certain way of thinking to write code, right? So if we talk about, you know, C# and doing things procedurally, you know, you have to like think in a certain way, like I need to do this and then I need to kind of call into this and then come back. Yes. You're right. And it seems like functional, you said that there's like this mind shift that you have to do, but maybe that mind shift was actually less than what I had to jump through originally. So, which sort of brings up a good question then. Do you think if you didn't know how to write code at all, do you think functional is closer to like how people actually think?
So I have actually seen people who are learning their first programming language that is a functional language. Mm-hmm. And they experience difficulties in switching to object-oriented language. Okay. It seems really complicated because, I mean, in the C# you have loops and you have this certain syntax that you use, like while, for, and stuff like that. You have exception handling with like null keywords. In functional programming, it's completely different. Like you operate with function composition. You have pattern matching. Like carving, you have this monads that you can create that simplify some stuff. But in general, it is not difficult if it's your first language. It is just different, I would say. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned a few things initially, but what kind of programming tasks are functional languages good for? What are their strengths?
Okay. So in general, functional programming is good for general programming. It's some people would say that it's better to do mathematical tasks or machine learning or some computationally expensive tasks. But I would say this is true, but also concurrent programming and distributed programming. It's really good to do in functional languages first because you have immutability, which is really important when you're working like with data and data operations and distributed environment.
So can you define what that is before you move on?
Of course. It means that you do not modify the state of some value. Every time you need to do some operation, you have a function that has some input parameters and that produces some output value based on the logic that function has. So there are no side effects. So the function can't just go and change some state of something.
And
so
is that a rule then? Like you have to do it? You have to do that?
I mean, languages like Haskell, for example, they are fully immutable. In okay. F-Sharp is not just a pure functional programming language. It also supports object-oriented programming, like comparative programming. So you can actually do object-oriented programming in F-Sharp and create mutable objects. But for that, you need to use a special keyword that's called mutable. By default, it is immutable. Mm-hmm. So it has this bias to immutable programming. But if you want, or if you need it for compatibility reasons, then you can use it. But it's not recommended. Okay. Yeah.
I like that. That it shows, you know, like you have to explicitly like go out of your way then to kind of do it the other way. But you can do it if you want.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
So what other kind of strengths does functional languages have?
So most of the people who have tried functional programming language after object-oriented language, they say that programming became more logical and easier than it was before. It helps to find errors more quickly. It helps you to structure your thoughts more clearly and to actually get things done quicker and troubleshoot much quicker and easier. I know that this sounds kind of like not very concrete, mm-hmm. but there are some functional programming constructs and tools that actually make it true. For that, for example, F-Sharp, it has type inference, function composition, coring, pattern matching. It has type providers and computation expressions. These are like language features that make it make up the benefits of functional programming in F-Sharp.
Don't wait for users to report problems. Raygun gives you complete visibility on errors, crashes, and performance problems affecting your end users. Replicate issues in seconds rather than digging through log files or having to rely on users to report errors or crashes. Raygun gives you a window into how users are really experiencing your software applications, supports all major programming languages and platforms, and integrates with your current development workflow tools too. There's a free 14-day trial, and it takes minutes to implement. So start resolving issues in your application and check it out today at raygun.com.
And now you mentioned that you could find like errors more easily. Why is that? Because I find myself like when I'm in C#, and let's say I'm working with like a list or something like that, or I'm doing even like a link expression. I have this, I'm just not very smart. So I have this terrible habit of like, I end up sort of setting a variable and I do like one operation and then I kind of do the next operation separate. And I, you know, like I'm super verbose in my code instead of trying to make it like compact and concise. And part of that is so I can like step through it. And like each step of the along the way, I can sort of validate like, okay, I found these items and now I'm transforming them in this way. And now I'm doing this thing. So like, what does that look like in functional programming? Like how do I, if I screwed up this like block of code, or maybe it isn't a block, I don't even know. In functional programming, how do I know like what I screwed up?
Okay. So first of all, in F-Sharp, you don't have null pointer exceptions at all.
Okay. Well, my code is pretty bug free, like right there.
Yeah. But seriously, I mean, the absence of null pointer exceptions is it's a huge plus. Yeah. You can just use pattern matching and option types. Like your value can be some type or it can be none. So you can handle all of your cases appropriately. Okay. There is nothing unexpected that can happen in your functions. But also you can create modular functions that have their own responsibility. They just take the input and they produce something out of it. And if there is an error, you, with simple debugging, you can, if there are no side effects, you can just find out and narrow it down to one function. And then you simply fix the error. So usually, like for me, when I write code in F#, if it compiles, it works 100%. you can try to prototype something really quickly. If it doesn't look good, you just rewrite it, write it again, split it up to more functions, and compile it. It works.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, so first of all, like Anders, I think he said that he wishes like null wasn't, you know, wasn't like the default in C#, like it didn't exist by default. Like you should have to do something. You should have to go out of your way to make that the case. And man, I really wish it wasn't in there, because especially now, whenever we're working with like these data structures and you have things that are there and things that aren't there. Yeah, I always run into these cases where I'm checking like everything along the way. And JavaScript makes it a lot easier. And I know C# has added some things where it's like, you know, you can put like these funny question mark things in and say like, well, if it's not null, then keep going. And, you know, it feels like we've just been putting a whole bunch of band-aids on it. So it sounds like F# just handles that better right out of the box.
Yeah. And another thing to mention, so if you look at C# code and F# code, it looks kind of different because F# uses the indent-based approach. Mm-hmm. So you don't have this curly braces and you don't have semicolons. It makes code cleaner, and like it avoids the unnecessary constructions that create, people can call it code noise. It just simplifies creating simple data structures or objects. So it makes data modeling really easy. It also has F# interactive. It's like a special console window, or you can open it up from Visual Studio or from any editor that allows you to really quickly prototype some things and immediately see the result. So you can create scripts. F# is great for scripting, for example.
Okay. And then, you know, so hypothetically, if I'm a developer that already knows like C# and JavaScript and some of these other things, like, and I say, oh, you've sold me on F#, like how do I make that transition?
There are a lot of great resources online. Mm-hmm. I think the most famous and most loved resource called F#forFunAndProfit.com. It has a lot of basic tutorials on how to get started and how to get used to this functional paradigm. Mm-hmm. So F# community is a unique community that is really friendly, welcoming, helpful, supportive. There is F# Slack where you can write questions. Even if you post, there is even like a joke that if you're new to F# and if you want to have F# friends, you just post a tweet with F# hashtag and you'll have likes and responses and you'll get help. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's motivating. So is that pound F pound?
F hush. Yeah.
I was going to say, cause that, you know, I don't know. I don't know how Twitter handles that. That's gotta be interesting.
Yeah. It's just F# and then F#.
Okay. And then I went to a friend of mine, Bill Berry, and I asked him, cause he considers himself a bit of an F# guy. And I asked him for like what questions I should ask you. And he wanted me to ask you a follow-up on that question, which was, am I already doing functional programming and I just don't know it?
I mean, you know it if you do functional programming.
Well, because I know, like, you know, there's things in C# and in JavaScript, too. Okay. I know, you know, I've done a lot of stuff in JavaScript, and I know that, you know, it's sort of, I think there's some things that border on functional programming. So I don't know how true that is or not.
I would say F# is getting more and more functional these days. Mm-hmm. It's just grabbing features from F#, one by one. And I think by, let's say, F# 20 or something, it will just be like F# renamed into C#.
Okay. But for the time being, I'm just a big faker at the kind of time.
Yeah. So C#, already has like tuples, right? So that you can return multiple mm-hmm. values from a function. It has pattern matching already, some sort of pattern matching. Mm-hmm. But I think Short still has the majority of functional features. So I agree that right now, currently, most of the languages are getting the functional features in it. And some people who are not used to it can just say, oh, that's a new feature. And they might not know that it might be originally from functional programming, like lambdas or stuff like that.
Okay.
So also another thing to mention about F#, you have a lot of freedom what frameworks to use or what editors to choose to program in it. Like Visual Studio is not the most popular IDE that is used for F#, for example.
Really? Okay.
So there is VS Code, mm-hmm. Which uses Ionide plugin that was originated from community. So it was written by, I think, Christoph. And VS Code incorporated this plugin. And you can notice if you write F# in VS Code, every day you have new updates. So like new functionality. It's really good.
So it's a pretty good experience in VS Code then? Like if I'm starting out, is that maybe what I should look at?
I think you should look at it definitely because it's really quick.
That's cool.
It's loading very quickly. Mm-hmm. You just type F# extension. Yep. It downloads Ionide and you're good to go. And it works in many platforms. So you can basically use any OS. Cool. Like I'm writing F# on my Mac. Mm-hmm. I haven't installed Visual Studio for Mac just to try it out, but mostly I use VS Code. Mm-hmm.
Very cool. And then you mentioned like F# turning into C#. So, I mean, do you see them like converging at some point, or, I mean, are they going to become so similar that I can sort of jump back and forth? Like what are your thoughts on that?
It's a very complicated question.
Yeah. Knowing that, you know, this isn't like an authoritative answer, which is fine.
It just seems like, C# and C# community is not ready for it yet.
Okay.
It needs some time to get used to the things that exist and that can make you more productive, I guess. Yeah. Some of them like curly braces and like the existing C# syntax. So,
I love that. Some of them like curly brackets. What is wrong with these people?
I have no idea. So, but I think that C# is going the right way in looking around and seeing what good parts it can take into. So hopefully one day C# will have most of the functionality that's necessary for productive functional programming.
Okay. Well,
but right now, functional programming is definitely, it is possible to do functional programming in C#, mm-hmm. but in F#, it's so much more easy. So
okay.
just simplifies it a lot.
So F# is in the same family of languages as like C# and VB, in that they both compile, or they all compile down to IL. Well, since they all do that, what do I have to do? Like if I have some C# code and I have some F# code, to start referencing them from each other?
You can do it. You can create a library in C# and use it from F#. Or, for example, there are some tools that are written in F# that are used from C#. It is easy. You mentioned that F# is from the family of C# and Visual Basic languages. But it also, I think the inspiration for F# was OCaml, which is another functional language from the ML family. And I think you can also do some interop with OCaml in this topic.
Oh, that's cool. So it's interesting, you know, because it does compile down to IL, right? I mean, it obviously is if they're, so I'm going to ask you a question that I, you know, it's okay if you don't know how to answer this one. But and I'm not. It's so complicated. I'm not even sure how to ask it. You know. So obviously, like IL itself is able to represent the F-sharp code that you're writing, right? So you're writing this functional code. Have you ever looked at kind of how that's represented? And can, you know, can you do like the same code in C-sharp? I don't know. I'm not quite sure what I'm asking. It's like,
you're trying, can you convert the code?
No, it's not even a matter of, I guess that's actually a good question. But the other thing I guess is, does that mean that IL has special representations for the things that you do in F-sharp? So those are my two questions.
It does. I think some of the constructions are different.
Okay.
That makes sense.
I mean, that's kind of what I was thinking. And then the other one, that was a good question. Can you convert between the two?
Haven't tried it, actually. I didn't think about it.
Yeah, I would assume you could go C-sharp to F-sharp easier than you could go the other way, but I'm not sure.
Because I know that like a lot of the code converters nowadays, like from like C-sharp and VB, use like Roslyn under the hood, so you can kind of, you know, get that representation. So it would be interesting to see if you could kind of do something similar with F-sharp.
Yeah, but they work really well with like VB.NET and C-sharp because those languages essentially have parity and equivalent operations. But in the F-sharp world, like it's just fundamentally different. So I'm thinking if it did work, you might not like the code. It's kind of like linked to SQL where, you know, just because you can write a certain link query doesn't mean that you should, because it's getting, you know, converted into 12 lines of SQL Server code, which will work
if you're lucky.
I've
seen like a one liner on link get like 1,000+ lines in SQL.
And it'll work. I mean, that's the beautiful thing. It will work, but you know, it's just not a good.
Do you want it to?
Yeah. So we keep hearing, C#, is evolving over time. Is F#, since I really don't follow the F# scene, I think you mentioned like VS Code getting daily updates. So is F# like continuing to evolve quickly as well?
I would say it evolves more quickly it is fully open source. It is cross platform. It has a great, strong community. And it has a lot of open source contributors. Like most of the work comes from open source contributors.
Okay.
So
wow.
F# has a F# Software Foundation, which is like a nonprofit organization that its mission is to promote, protect, and advance F# programming language and facilitate the growth and diversity of the language. So I would say F# has built a unique environment for open source contributors and for new ideas to grow into something real that can be created and put to work and made it be used by other people in the community. So that's why we have VS Code flagging. For example, there is there is a Visual Studio compiler for F#, but there is also F# Compiler Services, which is independent and which, for example, can be used by other IDEs that are not dependent on Visual Studio. So have you heard about Project Rider, for example?
Mm-mm.
So it's have you heard of ReSharper?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the same company that owns ReSharper, they have created Project Rider, which is an IDE for C# and F#, which if you miss ReSharper in F# world, you can use it. And I think it used this compiler services. You can do mobile development in F# with Xamarin Studio for Android, for iPhone, for many platforms.
Yeah, Frank Krieger made Continuous completely in F#, and we're like, are you crazy, man? And he's like,
yeah,
oh, I love it.
Like, you can just take your iPad and just do programming in F#, and it's super cool. It works.
Yeah.
So there's distributed programming in F#. You can use akka.net. There is a new F# binding to TensorFlow for machine learning, Hopak for multi-core processing. Of course, we can do cloud programming not only with Azure or Azure Functions, but F# community created like a special optimized for functional programming cloud library called Embrace that simplifies how you do cloud programming with the help of computation expressions. So you basically, you have your code that you would normally write, and you just wrap it around in a cloud block, and it distributes your function across the cloud. And you can use it with Azure or AWS, for example.
Okay.
Espose offers a powerful set of file management APIs with which developers can create applications, which can create, open, edit, and save the majority of popular business file formats. Their product range supports a multitude of file formats, including Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint presentations, PDF documents, OneNote, Outlook, Project, Visio files, popular image formats, and many others. Espose produces APIs for .NET, Java, and the cloud, which can be utilized in almost any modern language available today. Visit espose.com for a free 30-day no-limitations trial, and if you get stuck, message the friendly support team for help. All technical support is offered free of charge. And remember, if you are a lucky winner, you will receive a free developer small business license for Espose.net, a powerful toolkit for working with Word documents in your applications.
Are there like equivalent like templates for like the mainstream kind of like Microsoft platforms like ASP or like just like a console app writing that in F#, maybe UWP? Does that exist and work well?
I'm not working in an F# team that actually does the Microsoft compatibility, but I think there are some templates for Web API or ASP.NET. Not sure about Universal Windows Platform, because I think that was an open question some time ago, but I think it is in progress.
And I would think the console app would be there as well.
Yeah, of course. You can do the basic stuff that you can do with C#. You can use Azure Functions with F#. So there is this stuff, but I think, so Microsoft has a F# team, that is just a couple of people. I think, Philip Carter is a program manager on this team, and they're doing great work. So I wish F# had more support, from within Microsoft. So I wish Microsoft team was, not a couple of people, but let's say at least 7 or 10. Then maybe it would be possible to have better interop with Microsoft tools and F#, because the majority of work on frameworks is done by community.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that they're their own special small team, but do they work alongside the other .NET language teams, or are they just really siloed doing their own thing?
I think they're working within the .NET organization, but I'm not really sure. It's better to ask F#PM, but I think they're working on .NET/F#.
Yeah. Okay. But it sounds like, too, I mean, with the massive community around this, I mean, because I hate labeling, but like the you F# people are like are super, I mean, you guys are super passionate and vocal about it. So obviously it's like something that's really cool, because, you know, it's funny because, you know, when you ask me like, you know, something about F#, it's like, oh, Frank Krieger, Bill Berry, Lena Hall, like I know you guys, you know, I know the names, because, you know, you guys are doing like such cool work with it, and I'm kind of jealous. But yeah, it's that massive community that you have around it. I think you have, I mean, that's like something that's like super special for F# there.
I mean, I also want to mention a really like important thing that I think should be mentioned. At .NET Fringe conference last year, not this year, we had Don Syme presenting on the topic about F#. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned a really interesting thing. So he came up with a term that's called memetic independence. Mm-hmm. Have you heard about it?
No. Explain.
Okay. So memetic independence is when a technology can be virally communicated as an idea independently of other technologies, associations, and vested interests. So that means basically you can talk about F# independent from other tools or companies or technologies as of an independent technology and entity. And that is the thing that F# has. For example, when you search some technical keyword, and when you see that results lead to one company, that is probably not memetic independence. Mm-hmm. Or when your first sentence trying to explain the technology always contains like the same company, the same tool name, and like the same editor. That means it's probably not memetic independent. So F# tries to be very cross-platform and very broad and wide and open to everything, so to all use cases. So it's not only Windows, it's Linux or OS X and Windows 2. So the editors can be anything. You can develop on any platform. And this is where the language tries to go to.
That's really cool. I like that. I think that is a big strength. Anything else that you wanted to mention about functional programming or about F#?
I have a lot of things to mention also about F# things, F# libraries that exist, or F# tools.
Sure.
So, you know NuGet, right?
Yeah.
So, have you heard of Packet?
No.
So, Packet is a dependency manager that is written in F#, and it is used not only for F# solutions. It is really popular for C# projects or other .NET projects. It is designed well to work with NuGet packages, but also it enables referencing files directly from Git repositories or any HTTP resource. And it makes it really easy to version and control
NPM,
the packages.
Yeah, NPM has some of that functionality where
Like,
oh, there's no package, so I'm just going to point it at the GitHub repo.
Yeah. Another recent thing is, so F# has this library called Fable, which you can write your front end in F#. Basically, Fable is an open source compiler from F# to JavaScript, which is inspired by TypeScript, and it produces a really understandable, nice, clean JavaScript.
That's kind of interesting. Anything else on your list? You have the floor.
Yeah. So if you're interested in F#, I recommend to attend a conference in San Francisco in September. It is called Open F#. It is the first conference on F# in the United States on the West Coast. And I'm speaking there. So I think it will be great. It will be very... should be very similar to .NET Fringe Spirit. It is like community oriented. It should be very friendly, welcoming if you want to get started. I think that will be a great starting point.
Okay. And if I do want to learn F#, like what's my first go-to resource? I search for like F# tutorial, and it sent me to tryfsharp.org. Like, is that where I want to start?
I think the best one is to use fsharpforfunandprofit.com.
Okay.
Try F#. We're currently working on it within F# Software Foundation to like make it work for beginners. And also another great thing I forgot to mention about F# Software Foundation. So if you're new, there is this great free mentorship program. So basically F# experts, they provide some time for beginners to mentor them. You have about 30 minutes a week, I think. And they guide you, they recommend you resources, they try out some projects with you. And I mean, as soon as you become better in F#, you can mentor somebody else. So it's for free and it's great. You can benefit from this opportunity.
Okay, very cool. Anything else you wanted to mention before we move on?
Just don't be afraid to try it. It's really great. You will be not able to go back to C#.
Okay, well that's... that makes it sound pretty good. Very awesome. Okay, let's move on. So I actually have a hardware pick of the week, which is kind of an unusual one here. So I have a wireless access point with a built-in, obviously regular Wi-Fi routers have a router plus they're an access point. I actually wanted to split out that router function so that I could do things like VPN and some of this other functionality, and also just kind of offload some of that processing off my Wi-Fi access point. Because most of, the vast majority of my network is wired. And, I don't know, wireless access points, it seems like because of all the complexity involved are a little bit less reliable than you know, than like business grade routers. So I was looking for a business grade router, like enterprise grade router that was affordable. And I found one that fit the bill better than I ever thought could be possible, which is a product from Ubiquiti called Edge Router X. This thing is basically like a, you know, small business or enterprise class router for $50, which is pretty phenomenal. And it supports QoS and VPN, and it's got a couple hundred megabits of throughput. I'll even do like deep packet inspection. You can SSH into it and drop into a shell and start changing network parameters because it's based on Linux. This thing is like really incredible. It even has PoE support. So I don't know. I don't know how they sell the thing for $50, but you know, since I got it, I've been like making network configuration changes, and yeah, I got up and running with this thing in about 20 minutes, and I keep making changes to it, and I've yet to have to reboot. And reports online say this thing will stay running for months and months and months without issue. So I'm pretty excited about it. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes if you want to take a look at that. And then Carl, what do you have for the dev tip of the week?
So the tip of the week this week is a T-SQL statement. a lot of us, you know, we learn really quickly that you want to save as much date information as UTC as possible. Mm-hmm. And I follow that advice at work as well. Well, we got to a spot that, you know, normally we would handle it in code where you convert it to the local time wherever necessary. But when you're doing stuff like having Power BI or maybe some other kind of things hooking directly to your database to query this, you know, there is no code to interact with. So I found there's a T-SQL statement called switch offset. So if you want to convert from one offset to another, if you have the time zone information in there, or if you know that it's UTC and you want to convert to a local time and you know what that offset is, you could just give it that offset, and this will do all the date math for you. So it's switch offset, you give it the date object, and I think it takes all of the different date objects. So if you have date time two, date time offset, all that, it'll just work as well as the offset you want. So it's super simple and actually worked really good for some of the stuff that I've been doing lately.
Very cool. Okay, Lena, we play a game on the show. What I need you to do is pick a number between 1 and 4 inclusive and let me know what it is. And I will ask you a question that's meant for like 8-year-olds.
I don't know. Let's pick one.
Pick one. Okay. Would you rather always have a little green piece of spinach stuck between your front teeth or always have a little booger in your nose that moves when you breathe?
Oh, I would rather have sweet tea on a summer afternoon.
Whoa, nobody's done that before. Like you're really thinking outside the box there. There's not enough room to like write it in though, sweet tea. You have to pick one of the existing options, unfortunately. Oh, it's not me. It's the law.
I don't like spinach.
Well, I would think it would become, you know, it would lose flavor after a while. So, yeah. So would you rather have that in your teeth or the booger in your nose?
Do I still have to choose?
Yeah, you still have to choose.
Okay. She's trying to avoid it, Jason.
I know.
Okay, if it's binary, let's shuffle it and pick 0.
Or do you want the next question? I can give you the next one if you
question.
Want. Okay, the next one is.
It might be worse.
Yeah. No. Would you rather have your parents give you a pet pig or a big pet snake? I like how different, you know, these questions are.
So I guess it's just some American terms for things that parents make. I am from Eastern Europe, so I've never had either of them, so I can't decide.
No, it's the animal, yeah, a pet pig or a big snake.
Like a mini pig, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I was gonna say like that one's a pretty easy answer because, some of those pigs are actually make really good pets. Okay, Carl, pick a number.
I'll take number 4.
Number 4. Would you rather not be able to read or not be able to talk?
Man, that's actually a pretty rough one.
Nope, it's easy for me.
I think I'd have to go with, if I can't read, I can't do my job. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, that was pretty rough. I guess at that point, I'd have to choose not being able to speak.
Yeah. I think I would pick the same thing, especially with how dependent on computers. Because I assume you could still like type, right? So, I mean, I could just live my life through the computer. I'd, you know, copy Stephen Hawking's voice. Now that, you know, that app is open source, so I could do that.
But it's a WinForms app.
Yeah, well, whatever. I can deal with that.
Centennialize.
Yeah. Okay, Lena, so we'll have a link to like all the stuff we talked about in the show notes, but where can people find you and follow you?
I think the main place is Twitter. Mm-hmm. You can also add me on LinkedIn, or you can follow me on GitHub. Usually, if you have any questions, you can ask it on Twitter. I have my DMs open. So.
What's your handle on Twitter?
It's Lena Droid.
Okay, Lena Droid. Perfect. Okay, and Carl, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Carl Schweitzer.
And you can find me at ytechie.com or on Twitter at twitter.com/ytechie. So, Lena, thank you so much for coming on here and talking about functional programming and F#. It got me pretty excited about taking a look at this again and seeing what I can use it for.
Thank you. I think it's great.